Welcome to Legal Listening, where audio obiter is our thing. We're Carly and Zach, and we're so glad you're here with us today. Hey, just dropping in to say we're now on Patreon. If you want to support the project, head on over to patreon.com/legallistening, where you can unlock some fun bonus content with me, Zach, and some special guests. Thanks so much for all your support. So today on the podcast, we have a very, very special guest reader, which we're very excited about. Lisa Rodriguez, who is a current 3L just about finished at UCalgary Law, and she is going to read for us the decision of Crocker and Sundance, which is a tort law decision. We're very, very excited to have Lisa guest read on the podcast, and her introduction is absolutely wonderful. So I'll let Zach do a brief intro on the case, and then we'll hand it off to Lisa.
So just briefly, so everyone knows, this case deals a lot with tort law primarily. We talk about foreseeability of injury, voluntary assumption of risk, those kind of things. So it's a big tort law case, civil litigation. So if that's not what you're interested in, that's all right. But I highly recommend you take a listen because the facts on this one are very interesting. And I think I should put out there, you know, it's a tort law case, so there's injury suffered, which can be upsetting. So again, if this isn't for you, that's okay. We got lots more content on the podcast for you to listen to. So I'll let Lisa take it away from here and enjoy the episode.
Hi, my name is Lisa Rodriguez, and I'm here today to read one of my favorite cases from my first year of law school, and that's Crocker and Sundance. This case was taught to me by Professor Lorian Hardcastle at the University of Calgary, and she was one of my favorite professors that I've had throughout law school. She really made you laugh at the ridiculousness of some of the facts of these cases. And with this case in particular, it really seemed like the facts came out of a movie. You know, you have the drunk guy coming in, signing up to do a tubing competition down a moguled ski hill, then he inevitably hurts himself. So without further ado, here is Crocker and Sundance Northwest Resorts Limited, the 1988 case that came out of the Supreme Court of Canada. The judgment of the court was delivered by Justice Wilson. The principal issue in this appeal is whether the ski resort had a positive duty at law to take certain steps to prevent a visibly intoxicated person from competing in the resort's dangerous tubing competition. The resort contends that it had no such duty, but if it did, it adequately discharged it. The appellant Crocker contends that it had such a duty and failed to discharge it. The facts. The respondent, Sundance Northwest Resorts Limited, operates a ski resort. Sundance held a tubing competition in order to promote its resort. This competition involved teams of two people sliding down a moguled portion of a steep hill in oversized inner tubes. One evening, Crocker went skiing at Sundance with a friend. After their skiing, they went to a bar at the resort to drink. At the bar, a video of the previous year's race was shown. The video showed people being thrown from their inner tubes. Crocker and his friend did not, however, watch much of this video. Crocker and his friend decided to enter the competition and attempt to win the $200 in prize money. They signed an entry and waiver form and paid the $15 entry fee. The trial judge found as a fact, however, that Crocker did not read the form and did not appreciate that it was a waiver. The race was held 2 days later. On the morning of the race, Crocker and his friend drank large quantities of their own alcoholic beverages. They also bought alcoholic drinks from the bar at the resort. They were wearing bibs that identified them as tubing competitors when they did so. Crocker and his friend were the winners of their first heat. During the race, the two were thrown from their tube and Crocker suffered a cut above his eye. Between the first and second heats, Crocker drank two large swallows of brandy offered to him by the driver of a Molson beer van and was sold two more drinks at the bar. The owner of Sundance, Beals, saw Crocker between the first and second heats. Noting Crocker's condition, Beals asked him whether he was in any condition to compete in another heat. Crocker responded that he was. Beals did nothing more to dissuade him. At the top of the hill, Crocker fell down and his inner tube slid down the hill. The competition organizers obtained a new inner tube for him and his friend. Crocker was visibly drunk, and Durno, the manager of Sundance, suggested that it would be a good idea if he did not continue in the competition. But Crocker insisted on competing, and Durno took no further steps to restrain him. Crocker and his friend hit a mogul on the way down the hill. The two were flipped out of their inner tube. Crocker injured his neck in the fall and was rendered a quadriplegic. Earlier that afternoon, another competitor had been hospitalized for neck injuries sustained during another heat of the race. Crocker sued Sundance in tort. At trial, Sundance was held to be liable for 75% of the damages suffered by Crocker. Crocker was found contributorily negligent. The courts below. Supreme Court of Ontario, Trial Division. Fitzpatrick J. held that Sundance was under a duty to warn Crocker that there was a risk of serious injury in tube racing and that it had failed to discharge that duty. He found also that under the principle laid down in Jordan House Limited and Minot, the defendant resort was under an affirmative duty to prevent the plaintiff from putting himself at risk. The defendant ought not to have permitted the fateful heat to commence until the plaintiff had been removed from it, by calling the provincial police if necessary. Fitzpatrick J. rejected the argument that the plaintiff had waived his right to sue the defendant in tort. The defendant could not rely on the general exclusion of liability clause in the plaintiff's ski pass. It did not constitute a waiver because A, the words did not exclude liability for negligence, and B, the injury occurred outside the operations contemplated by the contract of which those clauses formed a part. Nor did the entry and waiver form signed by the plaintiff constitute a waiver of his legal rights, because the provision was not drawn to his attention, he had not read it, and he did not know of its existence. Finally, Fitzpatrick J. rejected the argument that the plaintiff voluntarily assumed the risk of the activity. While he may have assumed the physical risk, he did not assume the legal risk. The plaintiff did, however, contribute to his injuries by his own want of care in deliberately getting drunk and participating in the races. Ontario Court of Appeal. Finlayson, J.A., overturned the trial judge's finding that the defendant was liable. He concluded that the plaintiff could not establish that the resort breached its duty to warn him of the risks involved. Finlayson, J.A., stated at page 621, "In my view, there are two distinct factual situations here. The first relates to the plaintiff entering the race. As to that, it is my view that the defendant corporation took all reasonable steps to make the plaintiff aware of the risks of harm associated with the race. The plaintiff introduced a further and perhaps inevitable risk of harm in deliberately getting drunk. This created a second factual situation. I do not believe that this latter circumstance is the responsibility of the defendant corporation. Once it was brought to the attention of its president and manager, they did all that could reasonably be expected of them in warning the plaintiff that he should not continue. Further, he held that the defendant did not bear any affirmative duty to rescue the plaintiff that extended beyond the duty to warn him of the risks involved." Finlayson, J.A., stated at page 623, "Any responsibility they assumed was more than discharged by the warnings they gave. There was no special duty cast on them to disappoint the spectators and other contestants by canceling the race or postponing it until the police could be summoned to remove the plaintiff from the hill. Nor did they have to risk a confrontation with him and possibly Evoy by trying to take his tube away. Finlayson J.A. found it unnecessary to decide the quantum of damages issue. Had he been called upon to decide it, he would have ordered a new trial to hear new evidence as to the life expectancy of the plaintiff. Dubin J.A. in dissent would have upheld the trial judge's disposition of the liability issue. He noted that the resort had organized this risky event in order to make a profit. It was well aware of the plaintiff's intoxicated condition and, indeed, had supplied him with alcohol. It was therefore under a duty to take preventative measures to avoid the risk of grave injury to the plaintiff. It was not enough simply to warn him not to continue when such a warning would obviously be of no avail because of his inebriated state. The issue. People engage in dangerous sports every day. They scale sheer cliffs and slide down the sides of mountains. They jump from airplanes and float down whitewater rivers in rubber rafts. Risk hangs almost palpably over these activities. Indeed, the element of risk seems to make the sports more attractive to many. Occasionally, however, the risk materializes, and the result is usually tragic. In general, when someone is injured in a sporting accident, the law does not hold anyone else responsible. The injured person must rely on private insurance and on the public health care system. The broad issue in the present appeal is whether there is something to distinguish the situation here from the run-of-the-mill sports accident. In order to answer this question, the court must address six sub-issues. These are, first, did Sundance owe a duty of care to Crocker? Second, if a duty existed, what standard of care was required and was the standard met? Third, did the failure to meet the standard of care cause the harm suffered? Four, did Crocker voluntarily assume the risk? 5. Can Sundance rely on the waiver as a contractual defense to the tort claim? 6. Was Crocker contributorily negligent? 1. Duty of care. The common law has generally distinguished between negligent conduct, misfeasance, and failure to take positive steps to protect others from harm, nonfeasance. The early common law was reluctant to recognize affirmative duties to act. Limited exceptions were carved out where the parties were in special relationships, for an example, a parent and child, or where the defendant had a statutory or contractual obligation to intervene. The philosophy underlying this reluctance to extend legal obligation is described in Fleming's The Law of Torts, at page 137. The reluctance to extend the reach of legal obligation beyond this point drew sustenance from the long fashionable philosophy of individualism. The laissez-faire approach of the common law restrained men from committing affirmative acts of injury, but shrank from converting the courts into an agency for forcing men to help each other. Obviously, it involves a more serious restraint on individual liberty to require a person to act than it is to place limits on his freedom to act. Besides, the plaintiff's loss is unequal in the two situations. In the case of commission, the defendant has positively made his position worse. He has created a risk. In the case of inaction, he has merely failed to benefit him by not interfering in his affairs. Yet today, though far from defunct, the strength of these sentiments is steadily being sapped by the increasing sense of heightened social obligation and other collectivist tendencies in our midst. Accordingly, the legal doctrine which they once sustained is itself under retreat. Canadian courts have become increasingly willing to expand the number and kind of special relationships to which a positive duty to act attaches. As Linden notes in his text on Canadian tort law at page 304, There is a growing group of special relations which import an obligation to engage in positive conduct for the benefit of another. Normally, there is some element of control or some economic benefit inuring to the person as a result of the relation, which justifies the creation of the duty. For example, if there is a contract or a bailment, a failure to act may be actionable. It is not enough, however, if the contract is with a third person, as where a doctor agreed with the husband to attend his wife at childbirth. Carriers, innkeepers, warehousemen, and public utilities who hold themselves out to the public as being prepared to give service are subject to this responsibility. So too, a master may be obliged to provide aid to one of his servants in peril, a shopkeeper to his invitee, a school to a pupil, and a shipmaster to a passenger. Obligations to take positive action are also imposed upon occupiers of premises to make their property safe for the reception of certain entrants and for passers-by on the highway. A policeman may owe a civil duty to report dangerous road conditions. Institutions which have custody over people, such as hospitals, jails, and the like, may be obliged to take reasonable steps to protect those under their care. There will undoubtedly be additions to this list of special situations in the years ahead. The Jordan House case is the leading Supreme Court authority on the imposition of a duty to take positive action to protect another. In this case, the court held that a tavern owed a duty of care to its intoxicated patron. The facts of Jordan House are conveniently summarized in a case comment by W. Binchy in 1975, the Canadian Bar Review, at page 346. The facts, very briefly, were as follows. The plaintiff was a frequent patron of the defendant hotel's beverage room where beer was served. The plaintiff's propensity to drink to excess and thereafter to make himself a nuisance to other patrons was well known to the proprietor of the establishment as well as to other employees. Indeed, the plaintiff had been barred from the premises for a period of about a year before the events which gave rise to the action occurred. On the fateful evening, the plaintiff arrived at the defendant's establishment at about 5 o'clock in the afternoon in the company of his employer and commenced drinking. His employer left shortly afterwards, but the plaintiff remained, being served drinks until 10 o'clock in the evening, past the point of visible or apparent intoxication. At that time, the plaintiff began wandering around to other tables, and he was evicted by the hotel proprietor, who had been aware of the plaintiff's deteriorating condition for over 3 hours. The proprietor knew that the plaintiff would have to make his way home, probably on foot, by way of a busy thoroughfare. Shortly afterwards, the plaintiff was struck by a car and severely injured. The driver of the car was held liable in negligence to the plaintiff, since he had failed to respond adequately to a warning by another car of the plaintiff's presence on the highway. The trial judge's decision was upheld by the Ontario Court of Appeal, sub nomine Minow and Hansberger, 1970, and by this court. Laskin J. commenced his analysis by summarizing at page 247 the general common law position on liability in tort. I return to the main issue. The common law assesses liability for negligence on the basis of breach of a duty of care arising from a foreseeable and unreasonable risk of harm to one person created by the act or omission of another. This is the generality which exhibits the flexibility of the common law. But since liability is predicated upon fault, the guiding principle assumes a nexus or relationship between the injured person and the injuring person, which makes it reasonable to conclude that the latter owes a duty to the former not to expose him to an unreasonable risk of harm. Moreover, in considering whether the risk of injury to which a person may be exposed is one that he should not reasonably have to run, it is relevant to relate the probability and the gravity of the injury to the burden that would be imposed upon the prospective defendant in taking avoiding measures. Bolton and Stone in the House of Lords and Lambert and Lastoplex Chemicals Co. Limited in this court illustrate the relationship between the remoteness or likelihood of injury and the fixing of an obligation to take preventative measures according to the gravity thereof. Laskin J. then considered the relationship between the hotel and Minow and concluded that there was a close enough nexus to require the imposition of a duty on the hotel. The hotel, however, was not in the position of persons in general who see an intoxicated person who appears to be unable to control his steps. It was in an inviter-invitee relationship with Manal as one of its patrons, and it was aware through its employees of his intoxicated condition, a condition which, on the findings of the trial judge, it fed in violation of applicable liquor license and liquor control legislation. There was a probable risk of injury to Manal if he was turned out of the hotel to proceed on foot on a much-traveled highway passing in front of the hotel. Given the relationship between Manal and the hotel operator's knowledge of Manal's propensity to drink, and his instruction to his employees not to serve him unless he was accompanied by a responsible person, the fact that Manal was served not only in breach of this instruction, but as well in breach of statutory injunctions against serving a patron who was apparently in an intoxicated condition, and the fact that the hotel operator was aware that Manal was intoxicated, the proper conclusion is that the hotel came under a duty to Manal to see that he got home safely by taking him under its charge or putting him under the charge of a reasonable person, or to see that he was not turned out alone until he was in a reasonably fit condition to look after himself. There was, in this case, a breach of this duty for which the hotel must respond accordingly to the degree of fault found against it. The harm that ensued was that which was reasonably foreseeable by reason of what the hotel did in turning Manal out and failed to do in not taking preventative measures. Thus, the relationship between the hotel operator and the patron in this case was close enough to justify the imposition of a duty of care. This duty of care required the defendant to take certain positive steps to avert potential calamity. The general approach taken in Jordan House has been applied in a number of cases. Car owners who have permitted or instructed impaired persons to drive their car have been found liable, as has the owner of a motorcycle who allowed a young unlicensed driver to use it. The common thread running through these cases is that one is under a duty not to place another person in a position where it is foreseeable that that person could suffer injury. The plaintiff's inability to handle the situation in which he or she has been placed, either through youth, intoxication, or other incapacity, is an element in determining how foreseeable the injury is. The issue in the present appeal is whether the relationship between Sundance and Crocker gave rise to this kind of duty. The trial judge concluded that it did. He characterized this duty alternatively as a duty to warn or a duty to rescue. I find Dubin J.A.'s approach to the issue analytically clearer. The question, in his view, was whether Sundance Northwest Resorts Limited, the defendant, owed a duty of care to take all reasonable measures to prevent the plaintiff from continuing to participate in the very dangerous activity which was under its full control and supervision and promoted by it for commercial gain when it had become apparent that the plaintiff was drunk and injured. He concluded that such a duty of care did arise. I agree with Dubin J.A. that the relationship between Crocker and Sundance gave rise to such a duty. Sundance set up an inherently dangerous competition in order to promote its resort and improve its financial future. Sundance employees were in charge of the way in which the event was to be conducted. Sundance provided liquor to Crocker during the event and knew of Crocker's inebriated and injured condition before the start of the second heat. Sundance officials were well aware that Crocker's condition heightened the chance of injury. Both Beals and Durno questioned Crocker's ability to continue. It is clearly not open to Sundance to characterize itself as a stranger to Crocker's misfortune. The nexus between Sundance and Crocker is much too close for that. Sundance must accept the responsibility as the promoter of a dangerous sport for taking all reasonable steps to prevent a visibly incapacitated person from participating. The jurisprudence in this area seems to me to make this conclusion inevitable. When a railway company removes a drunken passenger from one of its trains, it owes a duty of care to this passenger to take reasonable steps to see that the passenger does not come to harm. Likewise, when a hotel ejects a drunken patron, it owes a duty of care to the patron to take certain steps to ensure that the patron arrives home safely. It would seem a fortiori that when a ski resort establishes a competition in a highly dangerous sport and runs the competition for profit, it owes a duty of care towards visibly intoxicated participants. The risk of calamity in the latter case is even more obvious than in the two preceding cases. I would conclude, therefore, that Sundance was subject to a duty to Crocker to take all reasonable steps to prevent him from entering such a competition. The question that must now be decided is whether Sundance took sufficient steps to discharge that duty. 2. Standard of care. By definition, the standard of care is dependent on context. We must determine what steps a reasonable organization would have taken to prevent Crocker from competing in the tubing competition. In answering this question, as Laskin J. noted in Jordan House at page 247, it is relevant to relate the probability and the gravity of the injury to the burden that would be imposed upon the prospective defendant in taking avoiding measures. In Jordan House, this court concluded that the defendant did not take the reasonable steps required to protect the plaintiff from injury. Laskin J. stated at page 248, "There is, in my opinion, nothing unreasonable in calling upon the hotel in such circumstances to take care to see that Manao is not exposed to injury because of his intoxication. No inordinate burden would be placed upon it in obliging it to respond to Manao's need for protection. A call to the police or a call to his employer immediately come to mind as easily available preventative measures, or a taxicab could be summoned to take him home, or arrangement made to this end with another patron able and willing to do so. The evidence shows that the hotel had experience with, or was sensitive to, the occasional need to take care of intoxicated patrons. The operator had in other like instances provided rides. He also had spare rooms at the time, into one of which Manao could have been put. Numerous steps were open to Sundance to dissuade Crocker from competing. It could, for instance, have disqualified him when it realized he was drunk. This would have been the easiest course to follow. Or it could have tried to prevent him from competing. It certainly did not have to supply him with a fresh tube when he fell down on the slope before the second heat and his tube rolled down the bottom of the hill. Sundance could have attempted to bring home to Crocker the risk of serious injury in competing while drunk. None of these preventative measures imposed a serious burden on the resort, and yet Sundance did none of them. Sundance officials made mild suggestions that Crocker might not be in any condition to race, but this was as far as it went. I agree with the learned trial judge and with Dubin J.A. dissenting on the Court of Appeal that Sundance failed to meet its standard of care. Finlayson J.A., for the majority of the Court of Appeal, thought otherwise. In his view, Sundance did not have a duty to do anything more than warn the participants as to the nature of the activity with sufficient detail that they can assess the risk themselves. This duty, in his view, was not heightened by Crocker's drunkenness. Indeed, Finlayson J.A. stated at page 620 that Crocker's conduct on the day of the race was most reckless as to his own welfare, and he asks to be excused from the tragic consequences of his actions on the grounds that he was inebriated. He ignores the fact that drunkenness carries with it its own hazards, and asked the court to reject any concept of individual responsibility so far as he is concerned, but to apply it nonetheless to the defendant corporation. With all due respect to Finlayson J.A., this approach is completely at odds with the thrust of the existing case law. The fact that Crocker was an irresponsible individual and was voluntarily intoxicated during the tubing competition is the very reason why Sundance was legally obliged to take all reasonable steps to prevent Crocker from competing. While it may be acceptable for a ski resort to allow or encourage sober, able-bodied individuals to participate in dangerous recreational activities, it is not acceptable for the resort to open its dangerous competitions to persons who are obviously incapacitated. This is, however, what Sundance did when it allowed Crocker to compete. I conclude, therefore, that it failed to meet its standard of care in the circumstances. 3. Causation. Sundance strongly urged that, even if it was negligent, its negligence did not cause the injury suffered by Crocker. The argument here is that tubing is inherently dangerous and demands no skill whatsoever. It is thus no more risky to participate in this sport when inebriated than it is to participate in it when sober. Sundance admits, therefore, that Crocker's injuries cannot be attributed to his drunkenness. The failure of Sundance to take reasonable steps to prevent Crocker from competing because he was drunk did not cause his injury. This admission is completely at odds with a finding of fact made at trial. The trial judge found that the risk of injury was greater for an inebriated competitor. He said at page 153, "It was possible for the contestants to slow their tubes and to steer them to some extent by the way they dragged their feet. There was, therefore, greater danger for an intoxicated competitor who would be less inclined to slow and less able to slow or steer his tube so as to avoid the moguls." It is not the role of this court to question such an eminently reasonable finding of fact. 4. Voluntary assumption of risk. The defense of voluntary assumption of risk is based on the moral supposition that no wrong is done to one who consents. By agreeing to assume the risk, the plaintiff absolves the defendant of all responsibility for it. As Fleming puts it in The Law of Torts, obviously, this defense bears much resemblance to contributory negligence. Most often, indeed, the two defenses overlap. The whenever knowingly to assume a risk is also negligent, for example, riding in a car with a drunk driver. But, like intersecting circles, some cases support one defense without the other. Thus, to assume the risk may in some circumstances be perfectly reasonable or, per contra, the risk, though unreasonable, may not be fully appreciated. As long as either defense defeated the plaintiff entirely, precise demarcation served only academic interest. But the introduction of apportionment for contributory negligence has posed a serious problem concerning the future role of voluntary assumption of risk as a complete defense. It seems rather odd that a plaintiff, who is himself negligent, might now fare better than one who is not. For example, that an intoxicated passenger should stand a better chance against a drunk driver than a passenger who is sober. The judicial response to this dilemma has been to impose ever stricter requirements for the defense of volenti to the point where it is now but rarely successful. Presumably, the reason for not formally drawing the defense within the net of apportionment, or what would amount to the same flatly abolishing it, is the feeling that people should remain free to agree to waive their legal rights, at least under conditions of free and informed choice. Since the volenti defense is a complete bar to recovery, and therefore anomalous in an age of apportionment, the courts have tightly circumscribed its scope. It only applies in situations where the plaintiff has assumed both the physical and the legal risk involved in the activity. In the present appeal, an attempt could be made to found a volenti defense either on A, Crocker's voluntary participation in a sport that was obviously dangerous, or B, the fact that Crocker signed a waiver form 2 days before the competition. I will examine each of these bases in turn. The first basis can be disposed of in short order. Crocker's participation in the tubing competition could be viewed as an assumption of the physical risks involved. Even this, however, is dubious because of the fact that his mind was clouded by alcohol at the time. It is well nigh impossible to conclude, however, that he assumed the legal risk involved. Sliding down a hill in an oversized inner tube cannot be viewed as constituting, per se, a waiver of Crocker's legal rights against Sundance. The argument that Crocker voluntarily assumed the legal risk of his conduct by signing a combined entry and waiver form is not particularly convincing either. The trial judge, having heard all the evidence, drew the following conclusion on the issue of waiver at pages 158 to 159. I find that no attempt was made to draw the release provision to Mr. Crocker's attention, that he did not read it, nor, in fact, did he know of its existence. Therefore, Sundance had no reasonable grounds for believing that the release truly expressed Mr. Crocker's intention. In fact, insofar as he was signing anything other than an application form, his signing was not his act. Given this finding of fact, it is difficult to conclude that Crocker voluntarily absolved the resort of legal liability for negligent conduct in permitting him, while intoxicated, to participate in its tubing competition. I would conclude, therefore, that Crocker did not, either by word or conduct, voluntarily assume the legal risk involved in competing. The volenti defense is inapplicable in the present case. 5. Waiver as contractual defense. Sundance correctly points out that a contractual waiver clause can serve as a full defense to a claim in tort. In Dick and Manitoba Snowmobile Association, Inc., the plaintiff took part in a snowmobile race. The plaintiff collided with Wood, an association official who, following usual practice, had signaled the end of the race by moving to the middle of the track. The collision caused the plaintiff to strike the outside wall of the track. The plaintiff was injured and sued the association in tort. This court agreed with the courts below that, while the association had been negligent, it was exonerated from liability by the waiver clause in the entry form. Sundance argues that the situation in the present appeal is not dissimilar to that in Dick, and that the waiver signed by Crocker should relieve Sundance of liability for its negligent conduct. In my view, this is not the case. There is a very significant difference between Dick and the present appeal, which, in my view, renders the reasoning in Dick inapplicable here. In Dick, the plaintiff had read the rules of the association that purported to release the association from liability for injuries suffered in the association's races. The plaintiff and Dick signed the waiver in full knowledge of the association's intention to exempt itself from liability. Not so here. As already mentioned, the trial judge found that the waiver provision in the entry form was not drawn to the plaintiff's attention, that he had not read it, and indeed did not know of its existence. He thought he was simply signing an entry form. In these circumstances, Sundance cannot rely upon the waiver clause in the entry form. 6. Contributory negligence. The learned trial judge concluded that, since the plaintiff's voluntary intoxication contributed to the mishap, Crocker should be held to be 25% contributorily negligent. Neither Crocker nor Sundance challenged this conclusion. I see no reason, therefore, for this court to interfere with it. Conclusion. Sundance put on a dangerous event to draw people to its resort and enhance its profits. It allowed, and indeed aided, Crocker, a visibly intoxicated person, to participate in the event. In doing so, it breached the duty of care it owed to him. It is accordingly liable for the damage that resulted from its negligence. I would allow the appeal with costs, set aside the judgment of the Court of Appeal, and restore the judgment of Fitzpatrick J. on the issue of liability. I would order a new trial as to the quantum of damages. At trial, the appellant's life expectancy was set at 2 years. The Court of Appeal received fresh evidence on the issue of the life expectancy of the appellant. The Court of Appeal were unanimous in the view that the fresh evidence would have necessitated a new trial on the issue of damages had Sundance been found liable. I agree. My conclusion as to liability, therefore, requires an order for a new trial on the issue of damages. Appeal allowed with costs.
Thanks for the listen, friend. I hope you're able to enjoy that case and learn something new from it. Legal Listening is founded by Zach Battiston and Carly Lyons. It is hosted by Zach Battiston, Carly Lyons, and you, our listeners. Executive produced by Zach Battiston, Carly Lyons, and Anthony Radomile. Audio engineering by Anthony Radomile. Graphic design by Julie Lundy. Check her out online at julielundyart.com. And music done by Matt Radomile at radnkel.com. At Legal Listening, we're always open to new ideas, suggestions, and of course, guest readers. Check us out on Twitter at Legal Listening or online at legallistening.com. Legal Listening, where audio obiter is our thing. We'll catch you in the next case. Bye now.